Hello and welcome to Hindsight. I'm Lorena Allam. Thanks for joining us today. During the two-year war between the US and Mexico, which began in 1846, a large contingent of conscripted soldiers, most of them Irish Catholics, deserted the American army to fight alongside the Mexicans. Known as the St. Patrick's Battalion, or Los San Patricios, the story of this rebel group and their battle against the US Army has become part of the national folklore in Ireland, and most especially in Mexico. In today's program, Colin McNaughton traces the footsteps of Los San Patricios, and along the way he discovers the complex play between history, memory, and identity in modern-day Mexico.
Freedom Denied, the story of the St. Patrick's Battalion.
I'm in Mexico City, a meeting place of many cultures and histories. I'm facing the Museum of Bellas Artes, which houses stunning murals by Mexican artists Diego Rivera, David Siqueiros, and José Orozco. Murals that tell of the tragedy and promise of Mexico. To my left is a park, which is hosting an art and craft market. I can see a statue of Beethoven. To my right, about four or five blocks away, is the Zócalo, the heart of the metropolis. People are everywhere. I'm here to trace in the footsteps of the St. Patrick's Battalion, Los San Patricios, a group of largely Irish Catholic soldiers who deserted the United States Army, switched sides, and fought with the Mexicans as they resisted the two-year-long US invasion which began in 1846.
For the United States, the Mexican War has no legacy. For the Mexicans, it never goes away. It's a wound that never heals.
And at the beginning of the invasion, some Irishmen deserted and formed their own company, San Patricio Company, to fight on the side of Mexico.
Reach your positions! Fire!
I mean, I personally think they were essentially soldiers of fortune.
And one man's hero is another man's traitor.
So the narrative of the San Patricios, it's a contemporary mythology.
Once they discovered they were invading not only a foreign country, but a foreign Catholic country, many of them decided, no, that's not something we want to do.
And one reason it never heals is each regime in Mexico, and they've had many, uses it to pour salt on the old wounds, to demonize the Yankees, so the people of Mexico won't look at the Mexican state itself.
It seems that we all Mexicans have this ability to go blind.
San Patricios.
About 3 years ago, I was at the Northcote Social Club, a music venue in inner-city Melbourne. I'd come to see David Rovics, a folk singer from the US. He played his song, The St. Patrick's Battalion.
And it was there, in the pueblos and hillsides, that I saw the mistake I had made. Part of a conquering army, with the morals of a bayonet blade. And there amidst all these poor dying Catholics, screaming children, the burning stench of it all, myself and 200 Irishmen decided to rise to the call. From Dublin City to San Diego, we witnessed freedom denied. So we formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side. We formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side.
I think it was in the mid-90s, the first time I had a gig opening for Howard Zinn. This is Howard Zinn, great historian who died recently, the age of 90-something. And he mentioned in his lecture, just in passing, the St. Patrick Battalion, and I thought that was very interesting. That was the first time I heard about them.
Overwhelmed by the cannons from Boston, we fell after each mortar blast. Most of us died on that hillside at the service of the Mexican state. So far from our occupied homeland, we were heroes and victims of fate. From Dublin City to San Diego, we witnessed freedom denied. So we formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side.
Manifest Destiny.
In the United States, Manifest Destiny is an absolute continuation of something that started on the ships bringing the people over in 1630 to found the Massachusetts Bay Colony, the Puritans.
Charles Bowden is an Arizona-based author and keen observer of the Mexico-U.S. border. We spoke on his back porch on a warm August evening.
When John Winthrop gave his famous sermon, "We will be like a city on the hill, building a light to shine upon all the nations," he began in this religious language for this small little sect, what became known as American exceptionalism.
The gospel has shown us that God loves us. Paul warns us not to be trampled upon by men in their tyranny, but to be delivered from the rigorous obligations of the law which force us into slavery. We are to uphold our privileged position now that Jesus Christ has set us free.
Calvinist belief lies at the heart of Manifest Destiny. Calvin believed that sin leaves human beings innately depraved, but because of God's grace, some are chosen to be saved. This perspective informs the notion that the American nation has been chosen to do God's bidding. At the time of declaring its independence from Britain, the 13 colonies that constituted the United States extended only a few hundred miles inland from the Atlantic coast. By the late 1840s, the United States, through invasion and land purchases, was able to extend its border from the Atlantic right through to the Pacific Ocean. The key to expansion was this idea of manifest destiny. In the first half of the 19th century, the new Republic of the USA was young and prosperous, with its eyes firmly focused on the future. The cities were growing rapidly, and the population nudged 20 million.
That we were founding a new Eden, that we were freed from the sins, decadence, and curses of Europe.
The source of America's growth was the widespread dispossession of indigenous peoples and the institution of slavery.
That we were divinely ordained, that we were the new Adam entering the new Eden, and we would create the pure nation, and this nation would be the agent that would purify the rest of the world.
As the United States consolidated, it began to look southward to the rest of the Americas.
The Mexican race now see, in the fate of the Aborigines of the North, their own inevitable destiny. They must amalgamate and be lost in the superior vigor of the Anglo-Saxon race, or they must utterly perish.
Please get positions! Fire!
Legacies of Conquest.
I'm walking with Aristóteles Flores, a Mexican mathematician and musician, on the outskirts of the Colonia Iztapalapa, a poor suburb of Mexico City. We're climbing Cerro de la Estrella, or the Hill of the Star.
And this place is a sacred place, or this place was a sacred place for the Aztecs. They used to sacrifice young women, virgin women, and they used to took her heart and give it to the gods. This is a place where the beginnings of the new age for the Aztecs began every 52 years. I think we were, well, the Aztecs were living the fifth sun, the fifth age, when the Spanish guys come to Mexico. So this is a very powerful place with a lot of energy.
The ruins of Cerro de Estrella is a sacred place, first to the Aztecs and now for Mexican Christians. Every year the crucifixion of Christ is reenacted, with millions of visitors from around the world.
My grandfather, the father of my father, he's totally indigenous. He's from Tlaxcala. Since I was a child, he told me about my Mexican name. And for me, it was the beginning of a tension between two worlds, the indigenous world and as a Mexican human being in this moment. There was an Aztec warrior that he was a soldier, and once there was a battle where they were losing. So this Aztec guy says something like, "I don't want to see my people dying. I don't want to see my people going down." So he decided to took his eyes because he didn't want to see that they were losing the battle. And I think that's also something that we have here in Mexico, that we don't want to see a lot of things like corruption, the narco, the violence. And it seems that we all Mexicans have took our eyes. It's something like that too. All the Mexican people is blind in some sense.
In the early 16th century, the invading Spanish conquistador, Hernán Cortés, raped the indigenous woman, Doña Marina, as one of the spoils of war. Doña Marina is commonly known as La Malinche. The product of this union was the mestizo, or Mexican race. In José Orozco's striking mural of this history, Cortés and La Malinche sit naked. Cortés's arm crosses the body of the brown woman, restraining her. The conquistador's eyes scan the horizon, while La Malinche's are closed.
War.
In the 1840s, Mexico, with a population of 7 million, lay to the west and south of the United States. Even though it won its independence from Spain in 1812, the legacies of colonialism were deep. At this time, Catholic Mexico was agrarian, aristocratic, and deeply divided.
In Mexico, there is not, nor is there any possibility of developing a national spirit, because there is no nation.
In Mexico, perhaps, the past is not really the past. Rather, because of the Spanish conquest, it's relived every day in what Mexican author Octavio Paz calls
cycles of conquest.
Señaladme la piedra en que caísteis y la madera en que os crucificaron.
Point out to me the rock on which you fell, and the wood on which they crucified you. Burn the ancient flints bright for me, the ancient lamps, the lashing whips stuck for centuries to your wounds, and the axes, brilliant with bloodstains. I come to speak through your dead mouth. The War of Intervention.
In 1845, James Polk was elected the 11th President of the United States. Polk's platform was expansion. He promised to seize Texas and all the land to the West Coast. Charles Bowden.
Polk deliberately sent troops south of the Nueces River to the banks of the Rio Grande, to the Mexicans. Their name for the river is the Rio Bravo, to provoke a conflict, to unleash the army. Abraham Lincoln stood in the halls of the U.S. Congress denouncing the premise of the war. He was in the opposition party as a congressman then, saying, "I defy the President of the United States to name one inch of American ground where American blood has been spilled."
And so, on May 13, 1846, President Polk declared war on Mexico. Mexico was broke, weak, and deeply divided along class and race lines.
Look, the premise of the Mexican War, for the people that wanted it, was twofold. One, to get this huge access to the Pacific coast for imperial dreams, to have a maritime port where we could exploit Asia and Asian trade. The other motive for the war was the southern states wanted to expand the country into zones where cotton slavery and agriculture could prove profitable. Now, this last reason is the reason that the war was really a southern war.
In the mid-19th century, the north of the United States was a growing industrial power. By contrast, the economy of the south was still based on plantations and slavery. The invasion of Mexico by the United States revealed the contradictions of slavery, which 13 years later led to the Civil War.
The St. Patrick's Battalion.
It's September 10th, 2010. I'm standing in the Plaza de San Jacinto, in the old wealthy suburb of San Angel, Mexico City. A large rectangle park, or plaza, is surrounded by cobble streets and stately houses, painted in vibrant colors.
Irlandeses. 2010 is significant in Mexico because it marks 200 years since independence from Spain and 100 years since the Mexican Revolution began.
The street at the top of the plaza is set up with a large stage filled with diplomats and VIPs. Chairs have been laid out for an audience. There's a large orchestra as well as a pipe and drum band. Hundreds of young Mexican military cadets march around with much pomp and fanfare. I'm here to witness how history and memory play out in Mexico. Here, an annual commemoration is held in memory of the San Patricios. On September 10, 1847, 16 men from this battalion were hanged. The plaque at the square reads,
"In memory of the Irish soldiers of the heroic Battalion of St. Patrick, who gave their lives for the Mexican cause in the unjust North American invasion of 1847.
Henry, John Appleby, George Galway, Barney Hart, Thomas Millet."
The high point of the ceremony this year was the unveiling of the bust of the rebel soldier, the Irishman, John Riley. Riley was the leader of the contingent of soldiers who deserted the U.S. Army to fight with the San Patricios, or the St. Patrick's Battalion. The bust is a little surprising, as there are no surviving images of John Riley.
Patrick Dalton, John Cuttle, John Price.
The San Patricio Battalion was formed essentially from immigrants, mainly from Ireland, but also from Scotland and Germany, a large majority of whom first enlisted in the U.S. Army, because at that time that was a path to citizenship for immigrants, and also the U.S. government had many land grants for veterans.
Historian Michael Hogan is the author of The Irish Soldiers of Mexico, He lives and works in the Mexican city of Guadalajara.
Remember, this was between 1846, 1848, which was the largest period of immigration from Ireland because of the famine.
The new potato, sound as stone, putrefied when it had lain 3 days in the long clay pit. Millions rotted along with it. Mouths tightened in. Eyes died hard. Faces chilled to a plucked bird. In a million wicker huts, beaks of famine snipped at guts. A people hungering from birth, grubbing like plants in the bitch earth, were grafted with a great sorrow. Hope rotted like a marrow.
Over a million people would immigrate to North America during that decade. So there was tremendous hostility towards the Irish, tremendous prejudice that Irish people, rather than being loyal to their country, would be loyal instead to the Pope.
This mass immigration to the United States in the mid-1840s led to tensions in the big cities. There were anti-Catholic riots in Chicago, Philadelphia, and Boston, with looting, torching, and deaths. Many new Irish emigrants quickly found themselves strong-armed into the U.S. Army, and in 1846, heading south to Mexico.
At the beginning of the invasion, some Irishmen deserted and formed their own company, San Patricio Company, to fight on the side of Mexico. Why they did that is also controversial, but seems they realized it was a very unjust war, very unjust invasion of Mexico.
Irishman James Fogarty is a former Catholic priest who's lived in Mexico for more than 50. He's researched extensively the history of the St. Patrick's Battalion.
Also, there was a religious element. At that time, there was a great deal of anti-Catholicism in the States. And there were brutal acts were committed by the invaders. They desecrated churches, church buildings and convents and so on, bombarded cathedrals and so you can imagine how that affected Irish Catholics from that period.
The officer class in the U.S. Army at the time was almost exclusively American Protestants. Catholic soldiers, whether native-born or immigrant, were often brutally discriminated against.
Private Liam McCabe was born in Ireland. Thomas Miller was American. Both were soldiers in the U.S. Army and were charged with the same offence, drunkenness and striking an officer. Thomas Miller was dishonourably discharged, while Liam McCabe was shot.
Ready! Liam! Fire!
The war.
The commander of the Mexican forces, General Antonio López de Santa Anna, knew about the anti-Catholic sentiment and the growing dissent within the ranks of the U.S. Army. He played on it by heavily leafleting the opposition forces. And as Irish soldiers began to desert and join the Mexicans, Santa Anna got them to write their leaflets.
Sons of Ireland, a noble race, for whom are you contending? For a people who, in the face of the whole world, trampled upon by the holy altars of our religion, set the firebrand upon a sanctuary devoted to the Blessed Virgin, and boasting of civil and religious liberty, trampled in contemptuous indifference.
The early battles were at Padierna and Resaca de Guerra, which were essentially artillery versus infantry. And the United States had superior artillery, but their alcance range was about three times what the Mexican artillery was. So they could destroy the Mexicans before the Mexicans were even within range of their own guns. The next major battle was in Monterrey. The Americans used the Monterrey Cathedral to determine the correct range, and in the process of range finding, killed many, many civilians who were in the cathedral, sent there by the governor to protect them from artillery fire.
As the war began in earnest, the ranks of the San Patricios continued to grow.
Trampled upon by the holy altars of our religion, set the firebrand upon a sanctuary devoted to the Blessed Virgin, trampled in contemptuous indifference.
And the next major battle was the Battle of Buena Vista, and at this point we saw what happens when the Mexicans had the San Patricios as a trained artillery battalion. Not only did their guns outgun the gringo invaders, but in this case, they were so accurate that they knocked guns off the caissons, and they were able to actually confiscate three American cannons.
It was also in this battle at Buena Vista that the San Patricios first fought under the green flag of St. Patrick, with the Irish Éireann Go Bragh, Ireland Forever, emblazoned on the side. And it was this battle at Buena Vista which proved the turning point in the war, as the American forces, led by General Zachary Taylor, were nearly routed by the Mexicans. And yet,
when that battle ended, at the end of the day, Taylor had said, "We've lost." And he was convinced that he would have to retreat the following morning. At dawn, he looked towards the south, and the Mexican army had disappeared. Santa Anna, worried because he was out of supplies, out of ammunition, out of water and food, decided to retreat to Mexico City to refurbish his troops. If he had taken the advantage and attacked one more time, he could have overcome the American troops and possibly won the war. That was a strategic mistake on the part of Santa Anna, and for that, many Mexicans conclude that he was in the pay of the Americans and that he was a traitor to his country.
Having narrowly escaped defeat, the next move by the U.S. forces was to launch a massive naval invasion of the port city of Veracruz. Thousands of Mexican civilians were killed in this attack. With the Mexican forces in disarray, the U.S. Army marched on Mexico City, and what was the major and final battle of the war, the Battle of Churubusco.
And there, once again, the Irish cannon outmaneuvered, outgunned the invaders. Even though they were outnumbered, 10,000 Americans to about 2,500 San Patricios and Mexican reservists.
Los San Patricios fought valiantly against overwhelming odds in the battle at Churubusco, and are revered to this day by Mexican schoolchildren.
This was the last battle they fought.
Enriqueta Cabrera is the director at the Military Museum of Interventions in Churubusco, Mexico City.
They were captured, they were killed, most of them, and the others were tortured, marked with a D on the cheek as deserters and things like that.
Traitors and saints.
Of the men of the St. Patrick's Battalion who survived the war, 50 were executed by the Americans. On September 10th, 1847, in San Angel, 16 were hanged. At Mixcoac, on the same day, 4 more met the same fate. On September 13th, at Chapultepec, another 30 San Patricios were strung up.
General Harney, who was in charge of the executions, had the men, 20 men, in nooses standing on mule-drawn carts facing the castle of Chapultepec, where the final battle of the war would be won or lost. And he said, when the American flag goes up on Chapultepec, then and only then will I execute these men. So they were in nooses with their hands tied behind their back in the hot sun for almost an hour and a half until finally the flag was raised over Chapultepec.
Fire!
Traitors or saints?
The reasons for desertion by the St. Patrick's Battalion remains contested to this day.
I personally think they were essentially, possibly, soldiers of fortune. I mean, we have nothing to say to the contrary.
British photographer and filmmaker Tricia Ziff is a long-term resident of Mexico City. She began a doctorate on the San Patricios.
These guys, many of them had fought for the French, they'd fought with Napoleon, they were trained soldiers, they knew what they were doing, and they knew their value, and they bartered it.
Once they discovered they were invading not only a foreign country, but a foreign Catholic country, as part of a group of cohorts of the Anglo-Saxon Protestants, who had oppressed them in their own native land, many of them decided, no, that's not something we want to do.
This notion of solidarity with the Catholic culture, this with rural Mexico, because peasants that heard the fiesta at the other side of the Rio Grande, and they heard music and dancing, and they remembered the Cayleys of Ireland, I think is utterly fictional.
The Americans would call them traitors, and one man's hero is another man's traitor.
Constructing the border.
In September 1847, at the end of the war, occupied Mexico was on its knees.
Immediately after the war, the capital was taken over by an occupation force. And for the next year, the American army was to collect all the import taxes. They ran the customs agencies. They also were able to confiscate all the mine receipts, all the silver and gold. So it was a very profitable adventure for the Americans.
That is Zócalo de la Ciudad de México. There you have the cathedral, the National Palace, etc., and there are the troops of the United States, and there you see the banner, the flag of the United States. Mm-hmm. And this is something that really hurts. Huh?
Enriqueta Cabrera. Immediately after the U.S. victory, there were numerous popular uprisings in Mexico. On February 2nd, 1848, the war formally ended with the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. For the sum of $15 million, Mexico ceded half of its territory to the United States, which includes the present-day states of California, Nevada, Arizona, Utah, New Mexico, Texas, and parts of Wyoming, Colorado, and Kansas.
Ulysses Grant, an officer in this war and later president of the United States, wrote in his memoir that this war was one of the most unjust ever waged by a stronger against a weaker nation.
Well, what it was just imperialism. It was using force to take ground from others who had less force. And then when we reached the Pacific, and we reached in and stolen half of Mexico, we just kept going globally.
The past as a prologue for the present.
The legacy of the 1846 war was a new border, but the war on and over the border still rages. A resident on that border, Charles Bowden.
But now the border has become a wall between a collapsing third world country and an industrial straits of the north. I am watching a death dance of two nations.
these drug cartels are now showing more and more indices of insurgency.
Segundo round, sigo representando el underground, aunque me encuentro en la cumbre como de costumbre, pues la cima no me marea, tal vez porque compongo mis canciones arriba de la azotea.
Gaby, espérame. No hay que alejarnos tanto.
I'm sitting with Aristóteles Flores on Cerro de Estrella, a sacred mountain right in the heart of Mexico City. From here, we can see clearly the horizon. For me, the journey tracing the footsteps of the San Patricios has illuminated the complex and shifting relationship between trauma, memory, and empire. It also reveals the power of history in telling us who we are, where we come from, and what we might become.
Cycles of conquest.
Well, I think it's something that every Mexican has deep inside. And I think the crisis has to be with this, with the history, the origin of ourselves, this behavior of being obeyed the Spanish people and trying to love their gods. So I think there are a lot of points that converge in a Mexican. So we have this Aztec past. We have also this, I have to say, this ability to go blind and to the Mexican facts.
Afilad los cuchillos que guardasteis, ponedlos en mi pecho y en mi mano, como un río de rayos amarillos, como un río de tigres enterrados, y dejadme llorar, horas, días, años. Edades ciegas, siglos estelares.
Sharpen the knives you kept. Place them in my chest and in my hand, like a river of yellow lighting, like a river of buried jaguars. And let me weep, hours, days, years, blind ages, stellar centuries.
And we need to begin from here, the top of this mountain, and as a symbol, as a metaphor of the sun dying. We need another sun to shine up there. This time, I think that we have to construct the sun. We need, like, new shines, new ways of thinking, new ways of love, and we just have to wake up and open our eyes and begin to live our lives in a new way.
Freedom Denied, the story of the St. Patrick's Battalion, was written and produced by Colin McNaughton, and the supervising producer was Michelle Rayner. Readings were by Sylvia Rosas, Nikki Wendt, and Gordy Blair. You heard extracts from the works of Seamus Heaney and Pablo Neruda.